Welcome to Newborn to Teen and Everything in Between, the podcast from Bespoke Family. I'm Bex.
And I'm Claire. Thanks for joining us as we tackle the ups and downs of life with children, helping you to get the best out of your time together. No rules, no judgment, just guidance. So grab a cuppa and let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Newborn to Teen and Everything in Between. We are so delighted to welcome Hayley and Becky from Paths to Parent Hub. And I knew, I was thinking, am I going to say that right? I have said that right, so that's all good. And we're going to be talking to Hayley and Becky all about donor conception. So hello Hayley, hello Becky, lovely to have you with us.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And I think Claire's just going to talk a little bit about how we were so lucky to get in touch with you.
Yeah, so I have a good friend who wanted to go down the route of being a solo parent and had donor conception. And a couple of weeks, months ago, she sent me a link to your podcast and just went, you need to listen to this. It's so interesting. She knows what I like to listen to and what. And it was just so interesting to hear from two people who are involved in this in a very personal way and raising a topic that really isn't talked about that much. And I think there's so many people who use donor conception for various different reasons. And I know for my friend, it's being part of a community as well and understanding that there's other people who are having the same questions or coming up against the same kind of, not dilemmas, but different concepts to think about and as the children get older. And so I had a listen to your podcast and now it's one of my get in the car, listen to you both. And it's like, oh, that's really interesting. Can't write any notes, but I have to kind of keep it in my head. And so we then got in contact and said, you know, asked if you could come on because I think it's just such a great topic to talk about and raise awareness of. So thanks for agreeing to come on.
And I think it would be great just to kind of start off to find out a little bit individually about your stories and then kind of about how you both met each other and started Paths to Parent Hub as well. That'd be great. So I don't know who wants to go first.
I'll go first if you want. So I'm Hayley. So I am actually a donor conceived person myself. So my mum and dad had me in the early 1980s through donor sperm IVF. But I didn't actually know until a lot later in life that that was actually my story, in the sense that my parents had been told by the doctors, obviously, not to tell me that I was born through through a sperm donor. So that came out quite late in life. And I started blogging, I suppose, about my situation, being a late discovery donor conceived person, which sadly is quite common for people of one of the oldies, if you like, where it was kind of common practice for us sort of not to be told by our parents. But then in a twist of fate, I'm actually a mum through donor conception myself too now. So I'm in a gay relationship, married to a woman. And in 2017, we had boy-girl twins with my lovely wife. So yeah, I suppose I'm in a slightly unusual position in that I'm donor conceived and a parent through sperm donation. And yeah, so that's kind of my story in a bit of a nutshell. And then I obviously found Becky through, as part of what I was talking about online, came across her Instagram account. And I'm sure obviously Becky will probably tell you now a little bit about her story. But we connected that way, really, just through the power of the internet. So,
oh, isn't it great?
Yeah, amazing, really. And like, obviously, we're all talking here today. We were saying, weren't we, before we came on air, how amazing it is that we can connect this way. So that's how I found Becky. And then, yeah, we went on from there.
Yeah.
The rest is history, isn't it? So my story is different to Hayley's, but there are so many similarities as well. And that's what I think when you start talking about these stories, everybody's story is different, yet there are common themes that run throughout them. So I was 28 when I was diagnosed with early menopause, which came as a massive shock, and was basically told that if I wanted to have children, I would need to go through IVF. I'd need to do it straight away because my egg reserve was so low. So my egg reserve was resembled that of someone in their mid to late 40s. And so we went through quite a difficult journey of five rounds of IVF. I did get pregnant on the first round, but sadly miscarried. And over that time started to think about the idea of using donor eggs, but at first it was absolutely, that was not going to be my story, that wasn't for me. I wanted it to work with my own eggs, and it was a real journey of grief, I think, of my grieving my own genetics and how I thought it would happen before we came to the decision to actually let's try this. And there's a whole story about how, what kind of got me to that point, but ultimately we went down the route of egg donation. We used a donor in the Czech Republic, and we were able to have 5 embryos from that donor. Had 1 embryo put back, and that's now my eldest daughter Mila, whose headphones I'm wearing today because I don't wear my own. And she's now 7, and then we went back to try for a sibling, and actually had 2 embryos put back, and then I had my twins Eska and Lena, who are now 5. And it was only sort of, I think Eska and Lena were about 6 months old, and I thought to myself, I really struggled going through this process, and I really struggled to find anyone else who really understood. And I thought, maybe I'll start sharing my story. And it was a friend of mine who built me a website, said, just do it, just do it. And so I created my Instagram account, which is called @definingmum, which was all kind of based around how I had to redefine what it meant to be a mum for me to go down this path. And what I wanted to do was give hope to others, to show them that it was possible and what life could be like. But also it was a bit of an outlet for me to share my story and to talk. And that was back in November 2018. So I've been doing this for 5 years now and kind of grown a community, but also met some incredible people along the way. And Hayley, probably one of the most incredible people that I've met, because one of the parts of my journey in sharing my own story was to start talking with donor-conceived people and understanding their perspectives. And there's a lot that's shifted from my own experience of using an anonymous donor and how I feel about that. But actually meeting Hayley, I was able to talk to her as a parent, but also to really understand some of the experiences that she's had and maybe start to understand some of the experiences that my girls might have. And so we clicked, didn't we, really? And it just became this like partnership where we thought, actually, we can use our own experiences. And we always try to be really empathetic and really understanding and compassionate towards how difficult this can be, but actually try and tackle some of the more taboo, difficult topics within that. But just going back to Paths to Parent Hub, it was back in lockdown that I created Paths to Parent Hub, which is a membership platform. And within that platform, I invite lots of professionals on to talk about the different emotions and psychological aspects. I have lots of people sharing their stories, and Hayley's been one of those. And just over the past year, Hayley and I have come together to collaborate, and Hayley's joined me in running the LGBTQ plus part of Paths to Parent Hub. And so, yeah, it's now grown. We've had over 1,000 members from all over the world over the past 3 years. And what we really want to do is just try and change the conversation about this. And that's where the podcast comes from as well, really. How can we start giving people access to these sorts of conversations?
Gosh, all of that that I've got, I've got a question about that, and I've got a question about that. Well, I mean, I just think kind of from my first question was, and please, like, I think we said before, you know, if there's anything you don't want to share, just tell us to back off. But what age were you, Hayley, when you were told?
So I was in my early 30s, so obviously, you know, fully grown adult, thought I knew who I was. I found the information out in a family argument. So, yeah, it was quite devastating, obviously, to find that information out, that obviously my wonderful dad, who I had a very, you know, fantastic relationship with growing up, still got a very good relationship. To find that information out so late in life was yeah, pretty devastating was probably the most accurate word. And it caused a lot of conflict within my own personal family. I knew I was an IVF, I was a test tube baby. That was kind of a celebrated story growing up, in one of the first in the UK, because obviously back then, very brand new technology. And my mum and dad were quite pioneers in some ways, really, even just having IVF treatment back kind of only a few years after the first ever IVF baby, Louise Brown, in 1978. So, like I say, I knew the IVF part, but sadly, yeah, what I wasn't told was the anonymous sperm donor part, which, like I say, came out. And yeah, it was just a huge shock. And it was one of the reasons why I do talk a lot about my story now, is to, even though, like I sort of briefly touched on at the start of our chat, you know, things have moved on dramatically in the last few decades in terms of early disclosure and what we do know now. Research has taught us that, and history actually, that it's the best interests of donor-conceived families as a whole to disclose to our children young about their conception story. But there's still vast amounts of people that still don't tell their children for lots of different reasons. Kind of that's why I sort of talk about it, to try and sort of say that there are other ways, but also appreciating that it is difficult to tell your children. I think that's often overlooked, actually. Those conversations can be really, really challenging as parents.
Well, because then there's so many questions once you...
Yeah.
Yeah. And not just questions from your children. Obviously, your children are young, so they'll have the normal questions. And like Becky and I, we talk a lot about how our kids are going through the different age, you know, the developmental milestones, so they're understanding their story more. But it's questions you get from family, from friends, from colleagues, like, you know, and it's how to deal with those questions and how much you want to share. And like I say, a lot of these things, I think people are kind of thrown in sometimes to donor conception a little bit is, okay, well, you know, like maybe if you're so in a same-sex relationship, you know, it's just a given, obviously, that you're going to use a donor, but there's no real support there to kind of say, well, this is what how you might like to talk to your child, or these are some of the complicating things that might come up. And I know, obviously, Becky probably share stories similarly, you know, they've gone through and successful and have a wonderful family through donor eggs, but actually kind of the support afterwards was non-existent.
I think actually just picking up on that from kind of the perspective of being in a heterosexual relationship, then I think it is easier to hide the fact that you've used a donor. I think it's not as obvious as someone who's a solo parent or in a same-sex couple. And I think historically that has been used almost maybe not to tell, or how do we do that? And so that's one of the key things that I talk about is how I talk with the girls and how I feel when I talk with the girls and how that's kind of story is evolving over time. And often I'll share a little kind of anecdote that one of the girls has said, and it's just really resonated. And I always use the term that mummy's eggs were broken, and we needed some help, and a lady did a very kind thing in giving us some of her eggs, and that's how you were made. And it's amazing how much little children can take it in, because we often hear from people, well, I want to wait until they understand. But you could be waiting and waiting and waiting, and actually putting those little building blocks with little children's books and just having these little conversations. I remember once dropping an egg in the kitchen and going, oh, it's just like mummy's eggs, and just bringing it up at that point in time. And they do, whenever they see a broken egg, they talk about my broken eggs. But it feeds in and it becomes their normal. And I think that's the difference with what the children today who are being told from an early age will have, that they've never had that one moment that Hayley unfortunately had to go through where suddenly everything changed. And so I think it's really, really important. And I've even had Mila, my eldest, on the end of one of my podcasts actually talk about how she was made. And she did a brilliant job. And she started it with, once upon a time, mummy and daddy wanted to have a baby. And it is amazing what children can take in. It's incredible. And I think for people to be able to see those conversations in practice, I think it gives them confidence and lets them know I can do this, and it's not as scary as it might seem. And it can get emotional, but in some ways I think it's actually another way of building bonds with our children as well. Like, I actually feel that in sharing this and being open about this and being vulnerable with my daughters has allowed me to create an extra level of bond, really, that we probably wouldn't have had
and
otherwise.
You're all in it together, aren't you? It is your story. It's not your story. It's the whole family story for both of you.
Yeah.
I think, we do underestimate children's ability to kind of take on information, as long as we do it in an age-appropriate way and we do it in a way that they can ask questions if they want to and all of those sorts of things. They actually thrive on us being open and honest. And I think when you were talking, it's kind of that whole years ago with regards to adoption, lots of people didn't know that they were adopted until they were older. Now that narrative is also changed, in that, you know, people are being told to let their children know that they've been adopted from a very, you know, right from the beginning, and talking about that. And I know people who have been told right from the beginning, and people who were told later on when they're older. The ones that are told later on have got a lot to process in, and I'm sure Hayley, you know, you 100% know this. You're processing kind of what's just been going on for the last X amount of years? And everyone's not told me the truth. Mm. And actually, now what is the truth and what isn't the truth? Whereas that's a huge amount to process. Whereas if you just grow up knowing your story, it's your story. And I love it when children have different stories to tell about how they have come to be, and they're proud of it, and they kind of say it, and other children learn from it, and it's an amazing thing that we are now in a position that we can create families in these, you know, with this, you know, we weren't in that position before, and I think it should be celebrated in a lot of ways.
It's a shame, isn't it, that Claire's talking about adoption, yeah. And actually what you've both said, it sounds like there isn't that. Obviously there's, you guys are starting that journey, aren't you, to make sure that people do have that support, but as an adopting parent, I don't know how you call it, but you would have, you know, we've spoken to somebody about adoption, haven't we? And, you know, they've done a book which, you know, explains it and all, but that's kind of come from the agency. Whereas for you guys, there is no kind of central place, is there, that it helps you know what to do?
No, there's nothing. It's a really good point, actually, you make there, Bex, because there isn't that support. And if it is, you have to kind of seek it out and find it. Whereas, and interestingly, the laws to do with donor anonymity were changed in 2005 in the UK. So anyone that's having treatment in the UK using egg or sperm donor or an embryo donation, the identity of the donor can be given to that donor conceived person when they turn 18. Now, that law change went to the High Court as a result of a High Court case that was won. But a lot of the research that was provided was came from the adoptive world. Actually, and that's what gave gave the weight behind the argument, which actually meant that the laws were changed in the UK. But you're really right, there actually isn't any, you know, if you're going through the adoption process, quite rightly, you have a lot of support, you have a lot of engagement with different services and assistance. And I'm not saying that adoption and donor conception is completely, you know, the same, but there are some similarities. I think that would be quite safe to say. But yeah, the support isn't there. And even sort of preconception, when you're going for treatment at a UK clinic here in the UK, it's not mandatory that you have to have what we call implications counselling, which is someone that delivers normally just one or two sessions, and you maybe have a little chat with someone that's trained, a trained counsellor. But that doesn't always happen. And if it does, the level and the quality of that counselling varies dramatically across the UK. Some, like I say, you know, maybe have one session, some will have a few. And really, I mean, personally, I'd like to see kind of, I know the HFEA are looking at it at the moment, our regulatory body here in the UK, of actually bringing in some more kind of guidelines, if you like, to bring in a more structured support. But yeah, in the meantime... Yeah. There isn't anything.
It's a real bugbear of mine, the fact that there's not this support, and in many ways in clinics it's often presented as though just another like treatment option, not a whole new path to parenthood. It's like, oh, you could just use donor eggs and I never had any implications counselling, because we went abroad and there isn't any when you go abroad, but no one really, I had to kind of navigate my own way through it. And like I said, around the anonymity aspect, if I'd have had that counselling, maybe I might have thought more about using an anonymous donor. And it's one of those really difficult ones where I regret the fact that the girls haven't got that option at 18 to find out who she is. I mean, we might find out in other ways, but also I don't regret it because I wouldn't have the girls. So it's a really complex kind of decision to retrospectively get your head around. But I do feel there's so much more support needed for parents going through this, whether you're in a same-sex couple or whether you're in a heterosexual couple. And usually when you come to this, like myself, you've been through rounds and rounds of failed treatment and loss, and you're in a really vulnerable state where you're making huge decisions, not only for your future, but also for your child's future as well. And there just isn't that support. And I often think there are so many parallels with adoption, and yeah, actually that's a real managed process. And some bits in there are really difficult for those prospective parents to go through, to make them think about. But actually we should really be asking those sorts of questions if we're going down the donor conception route as well, in terms of early on thinking about how you're going to tell your children, thinking about what that story will be. And actually, if they want to find out who that person is, how you feel about that, and how can you start processing that and getting comfortable with that so that you're in the very best place to support your children. And I think that's what the whole ethos of Paths to Parenthood is about. It's creating that safe space for people to come and work through and listen and reflect and actually support themselves and feel supported so that they are in the best place to answer those questions as their children grow.
Did you have to go abroad at that stage?
No, we didn't have to. It was 2015 and we had been on the waiting list at our local clinic where I'd had my other treatment, and we'd been on the list for about 10 months and we were no closer to the top. And we just heard from some other people who'd been abroad, and literally you can go, you can be matched within 6 weeks. And I was in, like I say, a very vulnerable state where I just wanted to have a baby. I just wanted to be a mum. I tried so many other things and I wanted this part to be over. I wanted to hold that baby in my arms. And so we made that decision, and actually we had a really great experience going out there, and it was really well run, really great communication, which we didn't get in the UK. But it's literally that, historically looking back now, I just think, oh, I really wish there was a way. And I have tried to ask the clinic, if I did write a letter to our donor, but they said they weren't able to pass it on due to the law, and that is really difficult as well. And I kind of wish I'd done something more at the time. Maybe they would have passed it on at the time, but you can kind of keep looking back and thinking, I should have, I wish I'd, or you can think about, right, okay, how do we support them? And there are so many ways now with DNA testing, for example, and that's something we might look at in the future. But at the moment, we're just focusing on talking to them, managing their expectations, and kind of crossing bridges when we come to them, but preparing ourselves to do so at the same time.
Yeah. I can just say as well, Becky, is a lot of clinic, we found a lot of members on the hub as well. They initially start treatment, don't they, in the UK, but like you say, for long wait lists, cost, because obviously a lot of parents or intended parents that are going through fertility treatment have gone through years and years of really expensive treatment, exhausted all avenues, and then really sometimes the only other option if they're going to have a family is to go abroad. But as Becky alluded to there, if you then go outside of UK jurisdiction to have treatment, the UK laws don't apply. So things like what you're entitled to in terms of information on any donor that's used, what's recorded, things like family limits, so how many other families can be created from one donor within that country, vary dramatically. And when we say implications counseling, and actually this is what we mean, is obviously right at the start when these decisions are being made, this information isn't really being given to parents. It's kind of just, they'll go to the UK clinic and then a lot of times get referred to a sister clinic in, like you say, Spain or Czech. And like Becky said, they do amazing work over in those clinics abroad, and they create amazing families, but sometimes that information at that point isn't always sort of transferred over.
Is there a limit to, in the UK, to say how many families someone can donate eggs or sperm to?
Yeah, it's a bit of a grey area. I could probably do a whole other podcast on this, actually. So essentially the law states that, so in recent years, one donor can produce up to 10 families in the UK. But, and I say but as a biggie, because so, for example, in the UK now, I think from 2019, the HFEA released their statistics, and over 50% of UK, donors that are used in the UK have come from abroad. So as what we were saying earlier, obviously there's lots of wait lists to use UK-based donors. So what a lot of clinics do, instead of, obviously you can either go abroad for treatment yourself, or you can actually import sperm. I mean, some instances, I don't think it's as common with eggs, but mostly sperm donors. You will import donor sperm from Europe, from America, but those donors can be used for 10 families in the UK, but there is no worldwide limit. So, and a lot of families will use a donor from abroad for lots of different reasons, whether it's accessibility, they like a donor from a different clinic, so they have more options, or they get maybe an extended donor profile, which you might not get in the UK. All these things that are quite attractive to do. But then what isn't obviously transferred over is that information again, that yes, it's 10 families in the UK, but it could be 25 in America or 12 in Denmark, endless really. So yes, we have limits. Yeah. But actually there's lots of ways that is kind of being sidestepped, sadly.
And I think it tends to be, obviously, more with donor sperm that the larger sibling groups happen. Because I think, obviously, the process of donating eggs is much more invasive. It's much more difficult
Yeah. And transportation of eggs is more challenging, obviously, as opposed to sperm donation. Yeah.
So obviously, you guys have told us your reasons for donor conception. What other types of reasons might somebody? I mean, obviously, Claire, your friend wanted to be a solo parent, mm-hmm. didn't they?
A solo parent.
So are there other reasons? I mean, I'm just interested to what you've come across.
Well, I've known so many different reasons that people have needed to use donor eggs. I mean, there's no just one category. Obviously, mine was, it's called premature ovarian insufficiency. But there are people with genetic conditions who don't want to pass that down to their children, so they need to use a donor. Mm. Again, that might be something they've known for a long time, and it might be that that gives them the option of having a child. Without the risk of them kind of having that condition. There's also kind of, we do know women are having children later on in life, and that
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah, so if you start, look at starting your family in your 40 plus, then your egg reserve is going to be low and you're going to have less of a chance than you would have done when you were 30. So I think I've spoken to many women who have been through multiple rounds of IVF, like I did, but they're in their early 40s, and by the time they get to have a child, they're kind of mid-40s, and they've mm-hmm. used donor eggs, and so that can be quite common. There's also people who have had a child with their own eggs and then want to have a sibling and suffer from secondary infertility as well. So that's always a bit of a complex situation. It's a question I get asked a lot. Do you know anyone who has a child who is genetically related to them but then has needed to use a donor? And they've got to get their head around that, having two different conception stories to build within their family story. So that can be another reason. I mean, there's so many different medical conditions. Endometriosis can cause kind of such damage to eggs that you need to use a donor. There's lots and lots of different reasons. But I think the key thing is the use of them is increasing year on year, and it is becoming more common. And I think that's another reason why we need to start talking about this. We don't want people now going through this in silence and thinking that I don't know how to talk to people about it. We want people to feel supported and they're not alone. And that was part of everything I started to share. And I always love the quote that shame dies when stories are told in safe spaces. And that's a quote from Anne Voskamp. And I really do feel that as people listen to others, they really feel that kind of relief. Mm. I'm not on my own. And that shame does die. It disappears because you realise it's not just you. There are other people out there. And those other people are like you. Mm. they're normal. And I think that was one of the things for me. I was like, I needed to see somebody else who had been through this to allow me to even get my head around the concept of using another woman's eggs to have a child. It was so alien at first. And so, yeah, I think story sharing is so important as part of this.
Just kind of going back, but Hayley, do you know your children's donor? And do you have contact, or is that something that you have with the anonymity? I can never say that word.
I know, you've got to take a lot of practice to say that. Yeah, anonymity. You know,
Becky's situation with regards to her donor, is yours different to that, or is it?
So we actually used a sperm donor who's open ID at 18. So that means that at 18, our children can request identifying information of who he is. We actually had treatment. So I found out I was donor conceived in my early 30s and then went on to have our children in 2017. And then I think we did consider a known sperm donor. So that's someone that's known to us. So that would be like a private arrangement almost. But there was a lot of concerns, I think, for us at the time over parental responsibilities, because we were a gay couple. You know, it wasn't that long ago, but it was enough that it put us off a little bit, in the sense of we were worried about, because it would be someone that we knew, even though I would, as the non-genetic, non-carrying parent, still be on my kid's birth certificate. If the donor that we used did want to take us to court for custody rights, he would be entitled to do that. And we were just, there was lots of things that we were worried about, and he also had some medical problems, the person that we had in mind. So it was a tricky thing for us. And I know lots of couples that have used known donors and it's worked very well, but I've also heard of situations where it's become complicated. So we decided, like I say, to use a donor from a clinic, but also OpenID, because I did feel, for me, I having obviously gone through the situation in my own story, I did feel that we wanted to be able to give that option to our kids to know who he was. So that's kind of where we're at with it. But what we have done is we have connected with our, you know, we were talking about family limits and other families that are created from the same donor. We've actually been able to connect with our children's donor siblings, so other families that have used the same donor. So we're in touch with them, some just virtually, and some we've actually met in person. So our kids know who they are and have that option, I suppose, as they grow, if they do want that level of connection with them. But I going back to like my story, I think what prompted that is obviously since I've actually DNA tested myself and was able to locate my parents' previous anonymous sperm donor, so my genetic father, and the several of my half donor siblings. So all of that's kind of gone on alongside my own path becoming a parent. So it's kind of shaped, I suppose, a little bit maybe how my wife and I are doing things now. So,
interesting.
Wow. And how did it go with finding your donor parent?
Yeah, again, and I hear, like, no, I hear you stumbling a little bit over terminology, and that's quite...
I know, and I did listen to your podcast on terminology.
No,
I just suddenly stumbled.
Yeah, and do you know what? Yeah, and it's, do you know what? It's totally fine, because most people do, and it just shows a little bit, actually, yeah. Because we, Becky and I, have actually done a whole, did a whole podcast on terminology.
Yeah, I listened to it, and then as it came out, I'm like, what was the term I was meant to...
it's that just shows, I think, because people aren't quite sure, because eventually, you know, what it comes down to is each family has their own language and terminology, and as a donor conceived person, like, I will, so Jonathan is his name, that's my genetic father donor, you know, I use multiple terms sometimes for him too. But yeah, it went really well, actually. I was very fortunate, but he was a medical student when he donated back in the early 80s. He obviously now then became a doctor, but yeah, he never knew when he donated that he would be found, I suppose, because back then there was no such thing as commercial DNA testing, which is how I was able to locate him. So I was very fortunate, because obviously lots of donor conceived people of my era, sadly, have had the opposite reaction. And haven't really been welcomed, I suppose, when they've maybe reached out to the donor. So yeah, I feel very fortunate. He's a lovely bloke, and we get on quite well. So yeah,
so amazing. Yeah. I find it so interesting, and so yeah, there's just so much, isn't there, from history coming through to now, and how that change of narrative is just so vital, I think, to ensure that our children grow up, knowing the world is so diverse in so many different ways, and that is all accepted and normal, and those conversations happen in school, and it was interesting. I was having a conversation with someone the other day about relationship and sex education, and it's not just that narrative now that, you know, years ago when we all had sex education at school and it was, this is how you make a baby. Yeah. And it's like, no.
Lots of other ways.
We need to be looking at all. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And children should grow up knowing that, because who's to say that they may need to consider that in their future, and to be able to come into it knowing about it and not feeling completely at a loss and overwhelmed and kind of going, what do we do? There's things for them to look for, you know, to come to you guys and all those sorts of things. I think it's a huge development.
This might be a really stupid question, and Claire's probably like, oh, what are you going to ask now? No, but if you go to a clinic, either for a egg donor or a sperm donor, do you find out information about the person who is, like, so their health, like, have what colour hair they've... I mean, you know, different... Do you find that out and then kind of choose? Does that make...
Yeah, it's not a stupid question at all.
Oh, that's all right then.
But yeah, and it all depends on the type of clinic you go to as to the level of information that you get. Yeah. So for us, in our scenario, we were matched by the clinic, so we were told to send it. I had to fill in a form, which was the strangest form I've ever had to fill in terms of what characteristics we were looking for. So we went brown hair, green eyes, she could be quite petite, I'm quite petite. And it's a very odd situation. And then we had to leave it in their hands to go and find a donor that matched those characteristics. And I remember actually sending some photographs of myself, which they didn't even ask for. But I was like, just to make sure. Because at that time, it was so important that they would resemble me in some way. And now I look back and I think that doesn't really matter. But it became very important for me. And then I was told very basic information. So I know that she did have brown hair. She had green eyes. She was the exact height and weight as me, which was just a coincidence. And she was born in the same year as me. So if you could put those things down on paper, it was the same as me. She was college educated, but that's all we've ever really got to know. I think I've managed to find out just through badgering my the person in my clinic that she worked in sales. But other than that, I don't know. And but there are like agencies in the UK who do one-to-one matching where you get like a pen portrait. They'll write a letter to the future child and you get to read that. So you really get a sense of who this person is and why they're donating. And I think that can be a wonderful thing to have because you can almost build that picture of her with your child as they grow and read the letter together, and you could potentially see childhood pictures of her. So that would be something that for some people I think it really depends on how you feel as to how much information you want. Some people will want to know everything, and there are places where you can go and you can see pictures of them as an adult as well. So it really varies, and I think that's one of the things you've almost got to think about at the beginning around what's important to you, but also project yourself forward in terms of what information do I want to give my child. And there are questions that will come up over time that I'll have to go, I don't know, and we like wonder about her. I mean, my girls have two out of the three of them have got very curly hair, and we often say that must come from our donor because my husband's side of the family, the hair is really straight. So, and I remember my daughter once saying that, oh, I think the donor might have put a bit of blue in my egg and a curl because I've got blue eyes and curly hair. And she'd really started to piece it together that she knows she doesn't get certain things from me. I know, and it was amazing. And I just thought, gosh, the thought of that at the very beginning of my child talking about that would have terrified me. But actually, I was really like, oh, gosh, she's really taking it in and this is lovely. And they know they don't share physical features with me, but we're alike in other ways. They pick up mannerisms from me.
It's nature and nurture, isn't there?
The same thing. It really is. And I think it is. It very much at first you worry because you think I'm not passing on my DNA. It's like my legacy. And actually you don't realise that every single day you're nurturing them, you're influencing them. They're picking things up from you. So it's just really opening your mind, I think, to the ways in which you can pass traits on to your children. But Hayley, I don't know about you from a sperm donor perspective, because sometimes it's slightly different in terms of picking sperm donors over egg donors.
Yeah, it was similar. It was obviously all online as well, so you literally just get like profiles. It's quite bizarre, really. And again, it depends where you go and where you're having treatment. But yeah, so I was the non-genetic, non-carrying parents. My wife did all the hard work and carried our twins, and we used her eggs. So we selected a donor that would, I suppose, look a little bit like me. And I think that's quite common, actually. So people would tend to look for donors, maybe physically, that look like the non-genetic parent. But actually, like Becky said, now our kids are here. Like, weirdly, we wanted a donor that was, you know, similar interest to me and things like that. And we actually picked someone that had very different interests to me, but maybe physically was like myself. But our kids are a complete mix of everything, really. We've got boy-girl twins. They're into totally different things, and they become their own little people. And I think that was probably one of the biggest things I've kind of gone on a journey with as well, is reflecting back on my own childhood. And I'm super close to my dad still, and very like my dad in so many ways. And he is the most wonderful father. I talk about him a lot. He is the first person I would call in a crisis. Still in my 40s, I'd ring my dad, you know, because he's just a wonderful man. And I take confidence in that relationship with my own children now, knowing that I don't share genetics with my kids, because I know the bond and the relationship that I've had with my dad. And I think sometimes, like what we try to talk a little bit on the membership too with our community members, is that there is a lot of fear, understandably, at the start. And even when we first become parents through donor conception, that the donor's going to, you know, our children someday are going to want to find this person because they want a replacement mum or dad, and a lot of it is not a lot of it just comes down to human curiosity. You know, I reached out to Jonathan, you know, my parents' sperm donor, to just find out a little bit about him. And I think, you know, that's quite Like I say, some donor conceived people aren't interested at all, you know, that we're a spectrum, you know, but I think it's just kind of going on that process as a parent, realizing that, you know, our kids may feel a complete spectrum of feelings, you know, as they grow, about the donor, and it's our job, I suppose, to support them through that as their mum or dad or parent. So,
and yeah. what you said about what your dad did for you and what you're doing for your children, that means so much. I mean, you know, you're saying your dad is a wonderful person.
Oh, and amazing.
Well, yeah, I mean, he actually, you know, used a sperm donor to have you. You know, it's like, that's incredible, the love that he must, you know, the feeling he must have had about having a child and then kind of doing that. There's no wonder. And you kind of think, for both of you, you know, the things that you've done to have your children is, you know, it means so much, doesn't it? You know, and actually, you've had so much more thought than people probably who have had children naturally, you know, which is crazy, really. I know that we need to probably wind up, but I just wanted to ask you, if you had any things that you would want to say to people that were considering donor conception, and then once we've talked about that, perhaps you could tell us how you can help them at Paths to Parent Hub as well.
So if you're considering donor conception, the first thing I would say is you're not on your own, and don't do it on your own. Like, find that support and find someone to talk to. There is an amazing community on Instagram, of all places, of fertility community, where you can find lots. Just search different hashtags, you'll find different people talking about their experiences. But I suppose the bit of advice I wish I'd have known when I first started was that it's okay to feel scared, but how you feel right now will change. You will shift over time. So we're talking there about the kind of that fear of being replaced, and I definitely had that when I went into this. And I think actually the anonymity side of things gave me an element of comfort over that. You know, when I look back now and think, actually, yeah, I think it helped me at that point in time. But actually what I've really learned, and I think the thing to hold, is that children have the capacity to hold space for more than one person. It's not one or the other. And I think that's one of the things that I constantly like hold close now, the fact that if they ever find that wonderful woman who did the most amazing thing for us, that doesn't replace me or anything that we've been through for the years before and the memories that we've made and the relationships we've built. And if anything, I think that makes me a better mother in sort of being able to embrace that and open myself up to that, because actually without her, they wouldn't exist. And without her, I wouldn't be a mum. So, yeah, I think it is just almost allowing yourself to understand why you're feeling the way you're feeling, but actually know that over time it's a process, and you will shift, you will change, and get that support, I think, to get you there and to support yourself throughout this. That would be my advice.
Pretty good advice there, Becky. I suppose for me, I think I would say, if you've got the capacity and you have the time, because I know obviously in some situations people don't always have time on their side, but I think it's really important to do your homework, do a little bit of research into your options, and obviously not everyone will have the same options, and I'm very mindful of that. But yeah, just going back to some of the things that we've kind of discussed here today, looking at your donor selection, looking at where that donor is also used around the world, if you're using an import, because that will potentially impact your child further on down the line. And just try to get a little bit more educated. And I know that's really easy said than done, because you have to find the resources in the first place. But yeah, even just trying to listen to a few podcasts, or like Becky recommended there, going on Instagram and just listening to some other people that have maybe walked that path, whether they're donor conceived donors as well, because there's donors out there talking about their experience, and also parents. And yeah, just spending a little bit of time of kind of just researching the area, because they're really important decisions that you'll be making. So that would be mine.
And what do you guys do at Paths to Parent Hub? Just briefly what you do and where people can find you and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so Paths to Parent Hub, it's a membership community, and within that community we have, there's a private app that you get access to where you can connect with others. So I think quite often people don't want to be as open about this, so I think they often kind of follow anonymous accounts and things on Instagram. So this is a space where you can know it's on your phone, it's not, it's very discreet, you can connect with other people. We have monthly virtual support calls where you can go. It's kind of like a virtual connection group. You can speak with other people. And we have calls for those that are either trying to conceive or those that are pregnant and parenting, which is a great way of meeting people. There's also quite a lot of regular meetups that are happening and popping up all over the country, which is amazing. And also we host monthly webinars, and we've got a whole back catalogue of content where we talk about all of these different topics with professionals. So we've got conversations around attachment and bonding, grieving the loss of your genetics. We've got conversations around epigenetics and other things around talking to your children. We've got a brilliant series with a child psychologist where we talk about how the conversation might evolve as they grow. So we've really tried to think of all the different stages. And then the final thing is there's so many recorded stories of different people with different experiences. So whether they are donor conceived people that we can learn from or other parents. And like I said, everybody's got a slightly different story. So if you can find someone who you think actually resonates with you, we're really trying to build up the diversity in the hub this year as well around different kind of ethnic communities who maybe don't talk about this as much as other communities, and actually it can be even lonelier for those people. So we're really trying to build that up. And then Hayley, I'm going to let you talk about the LGBTQ plus side, because that's another element that we've added.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of work, haven't we, over the last 12 months on that. And I think, again, it's just making sure that we're really inclusive and that anyone that joins the membership, they will find content that relates to their family and the slight nuances. Obviously, there's lots of similarities. We're all trying to raise our kids and struggling through all that, aren't we? Whether you come to parenting through donor conception or not, I think parenting is just challenging, isn't it? But it's always nice to find other families that look like you and that you can relate to. So we've built a lot of content now specific to our LGBTQ plus members, again, through live chats and specific supportive professional webinars that address maybe some of the more nuanced topics to do with our LGBTQ and queer family building. And it's great to see more and more members from that kind of community as well joining. Like you say, we're excited where it's going to go, Becky, aren't we? What I will say as well about the hub is that we've tried to make the content, as well as being accessible, but a lot of people find, again, when they turn to things like social media and things to get their information and support, it can seem quite overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So we've tried to really structure our content now. So we've got specific pathways. So say you're looking to maybe trying to conceive through egg donation, we've actually got a whole pathway that members can join. And then all the content we've got is actually structured, and we take people through a set path, so it's not so overwhelming, because otherwise, like you say, you don't always know where to start. So yeah, that's kind of our membership in a nutshell.
Sounds incredible.
It's been a privilege to work on it. Like I say, I'm thrilled to be doing more work now with Becky, and we're expanding every month.
So we can find at Paths to Parent Hub.
Yeah.
On Instagram. And Becky, you're
Defining Mum.
Defining Mum.
Yes.
And are you on Instagram, Hayley, as well?
I am, yeah. So I haven't got the most easiest of handles. I'm DCP Journey to RP, which actually means Donor Conceived Person's Journey to Recipient Parent. I didn't think at all about that when I set it up. I've also got my own website, All Things Donor Conception, okay, where you can find the hub. You can find Paths to Parent Hub details on there. Okay. But I also got lots of free resources on there. But if people are specifically interested in the hub, if you just put in pathstoparenthub.com, you'll find us and you'll find our website.
And we'll put all of those links in our show notes so everybody have it. Honestly, I could literally have chatted to you for ages. It's been amazing. Yeah. So interesting. And I think something that, as you said, is not talked about enough, and there's just so many questions. And you know, we're just glad you're there for everybody that is going through that and wants to go through it. So thanks so much for coming on and talking about it.
So
we really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us. It's amazing to be able to just get on different platforms and share about this. It is an amazing path to parenthood, but it's not always easy. So, nice to be able to share.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. That's everything for today. Thanks for listening. If there's something you'd like us to talk about, we'd love you to get in touch and let us know. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at Bespoke Family, or head to our website. The links are in our show notes.
Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next episode, and please give us a rating or review if you like what you hear. We're Bex and Claire, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Newborn to Teen and everything in between. See you then.